Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. Later on in the show, we're going to preview a new NASA mission, the Interstellar Mapping and Acceleration Probe, or IMAP, with its principal investigator, Princeton University space plasma physicist, Dave McComas. He's going to talk about the bubble of charged particles that surrounds the sun and the planets, the heliosphere, and what we're learning about its boundary with interstellar space. But first up, we're joined by Nina Lanza from the Los Alamos National Laboratory. Nina is a science team member for the SuperCam instrument on the Mars 2020 rover Perseverance, and she joins us to talk about recordings that the rover has recently made using microphones to catch the sounds of exploring Jezero Crater on Mars. Nina Lanza, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Before we go any further, I'd like to know a little bit more about you because you've got a pretty fascinating background. Give us a little bit about your pathway, about how you got involved in the Mars rovers, because you're also the principal investigator for the camera on Curiosity, right?
That's right. Yes. So I feel like I have the best job in the world, and I feel like I'm living my childhood dream of working on a spaceship, now two spaceships, with lasers. So when I, when I was growing up, I loved space and I was always really fascinated. And that really started when my parents took me to an outreach event. I grew up in Boston, Massachusetts. And so it was Halley's Comet was passing by.
1986.
That's right. Exactly. So I was 7 years old and my parents took me to a local university and there was a lecture beforehand. And I admit that I did not really pay attention to that. But when we went out onto the roof to look through the telescope, I was shocked to see something there that I had never imagined. And I realized at that moment that space was this three-dimensional place and there were all kinds of things out there. And I really wanted to know what else was out there. And that launched me into, you know, my career eventually, you know, but of course I didn't really know how to go from, you know, loving space to working on a spaceship, but I just followed all the opportunities that came my way, sort of a twisting path, but eventually I was able to work with the folks at Los Alamos National Laboratory as a student, even before I went to grad school. And so that's how I really launched my path here to where I am now, which is working on both of these wonderful missions, Curiosity and Perseverance.
Yeah, and it's always fascinates me because I've heard this story so many times over the years about how it's parents taking a child to an event like that, to a planetarium or a museum or an aquarium that sparks that interest that turns into a lifelong passion. I've heard this story so many times and I love it every time I hear it.
Well, yeah, you know, it really emphasizes how important it is to reach out and to talk to people about what you're doing because you have no idea who you're actually reaching. And a lot of times people don't know that they love something just because they don't know about that thing. So for me, I think that's something I've brought forward into my professional career. Outreach is really important to me because again, you never know what thing you might say to someone that could really change the course of their life.
Well, that's why we decided to reach out to you because you're so good at outreach. You really are. It's fun to talk to you and listen to your passion for space exploration.
Oh, thank you. Well, I just love sharing my enthusiasm.
Well, the other thing I'd like to ask you about for our listeners is most people would not associate Los Alamos National Laboratory with a NASA mission like the rovers on Mars. Could you explain, you know, how Los Alamos fits into this, the big picture of exploring Mars?
Sure. Yeah. Again, as you said, most people don't connect Los Alamos with space, but it turns out Los Alamos has a long history of contributing both instruments and spacecraft to space missions. So I think something like we've launched something like 500 instruments. It's something really huge number. But our involvement is that we have this, you know, we have capabilities that we can apply to many different arenas, right? So what we're doing with ChemCam and SuperCam is really stuff that we can do on Earth and we do on Earth, but we're applying it to this new extreme environment on Mars.
Well, one of the things that really fascinated me recently was listening to the sounds from Mars, and we'll get into those in more detail in a moment. But when was it decided to start putting microphones on the rovers? And is Perseverance the first one with a microphone, or does Curiosity have mics?
So the microphones we have on Perseverance are the very first microphones that made it to Mars and operated. But the idea of putting microphones on Mars is actually a long-standing one. People have been wanting to hear what Mars sounds like for a really long time. But there's a lot of reasons why this hasn't happened. It's a long and complex history. So we were really excited when we were able to actually, you know, put a microphone onto our instrument and have it actually work. So our path to the microphone on SuperCam was a little bit circuitous because we didn't actually put that into the mission, the proposal for the instrument. It was something that we decided to add on afterward. And that's just because we had the opportunity to do it. And it's a pretty straightforward piece of hardware. But of course, there's always the chance that it's not going to work after it's been in space for 8 or 9 months. So we were really excited that we were able to do it and it worked.
Well, tell us about the microphones themselves, because my understanding is they're kind of pretty standard microphones.
Yeah, it's really funny. You'd think that we'd need something really, really high tech to operate on another planet. But it turns out that both of the microphones are essentially commercial off-the-shelf microphones that you can just buy. There are two different companies involved. So the microphone that's on SuperCam is from the company Knowles. And the microphone, which is the entry, descent, and landing microphone, is from another company. I'm totally forgetting the company name just because I'm not working on that. But they, both of these companies can provide these microphones to other people on Earth if you wanted to listen to the world in using the same ears that Perseverance has.
Wow, that's pretty cool. You could if you wanted to get into podcasting, folks, you could use a microphone that is used on Mars.
Yeah, I mean, I would love to actually be able to, you know, hear what the rover has to say. Wouldn't it be great if the rover could do a podcast from Mars?
Well, you could probably do that. I bet you could be the voice of Percy.
Oh, gosh, what would I do for that voice? I'd have to think about that.
We have to think about that. Okay, well, let's talk about sound on Mars, because it's not like, just like everywhere else, when we talk about what the moon is like or what Mars is like, it's not Earth. And it's a different kind of atmosphere. It's so much thinner. So talk about the Mars atmosphere and sound propagation on Mars compared to Earth.
Yeah, so the atmosphere on Mars is very different from the atmosphere on Earth in a number of ways. As you mentioned, it's a lot less dense. It's just a lot thinner. But it's also a very different composition. So it's mostly carbon dioxide. And the Mars ambient temperatures tend to be a lot colder than on Earth. So all of those things together means that sound is going to travel through the Martian atmosphere very differently on Mars and than it does on Earth, right? So one of the ways that we can actually measure that is that sound should be slower on Mars. Now, if you were on the surface of Mars and somehow didn't have a helmet, you probably wouldn't notice that, but it's something you can measure. Another thing is that sound will also sound different depending on its frequency in the Martian atmosphere. So the higher frequencies will be attenuated in the Martian atmosphere. So that means that it sounds much quieter than what you would be used to on Earth. And so if you were, you know, making a very high-pitched sound without your helmet, maybe you were screaming for air, it would be harder for people to hear you just because your high-pitched screams would be attenuated. And then just in general, it's really hard for sound to propagate in a thin atmosphere like that. So sounds will generally sound much quieter on the Martian surface.
So, you know, pretend that we could just have our helmet off without anything bad happening. And of course, you can't do that. But if you could, would the sounds be really different, or would you be able to hear them as compared to the sounds that you were going to play back in a few moments? In other words, did you have to do like sound processing for us to be able to hear this, or would the human ear be able to hear it on Mars?
It really depends on how far away the sound is. But I think if you were putting yourself in the rover's wheels and you were standing there listening to these sounds, I think what it would sound like is that everything sounds pretty normal, but it's very, very quiet. That's probably the biggest thing that you would notice if you were standing there.
So you'd need really good hearing aids and turn it up.
That's right. I think if you did that, then you would probably notice that there is something weird about the sound balance, right? The higher pitched sounds were just be so quiet compared to those lower pitched sounds. And that would probably be somewhat disorienting. So when you hear sounds that we've recorded on Mars, you know, it's sometimes hard to compare because you don't have that same sound on Earth. But you can hear that these higher pitched frequencies just really are missing.
Well, let's listen to some of those sounds. I know Matt is able to cue them up. Let's listen to the sound of wind on Mars, and then we could talk a bit about what that tells us. Okay, well, that sounds, you know, quite a bit like the sound of wind on Earth. What are some of the things when you first heard that, and your fellow scientists, what are some of the things we've learned about Mars' atmosphere and how the microphones work from listening to the sound of wind on Mars?
First, I mean, how cool is that? We just listen to the sound of wind on another planet. I mean, it just really, to me, feels very visceral. So I think that is, you know, the first reaction that I had. What you can hear in there, though, is that it's relatively low pitched, and that's what we would expect. I think what we've been doing the most with that sound is trying to connect it to things that we're seeing in the atmosphere, things like dust devils, you know, vortices, and sand lifting events. You can actually connect those sounds and the sound of that turbulent atmosphere with those actions. And that's really helpful. So I'm not an atmospheric scientist, so this is not the work that I do, but I know they can actually put these things together to get a better sense of how sounds are propagating through the Martian atmosphere.
And was there some surprise at, you know, what they're hearing based on their models of what they thought they would hear before? Have we been surprised at all by these sounds?
Absolutely. That's one of the most exciting results, I think, from these microphones, and really maybe from Mars right now. We have these models of how sound should propagate based on our understanding of the properties of the atmosphere that we talked about, like density, composition, temperature, et cetera. So we knew how sound should probably behave. But as we've been recording sounds, it turns out that it's not like the model at all. In fact, it propagates sound on Mars so much more than we thought it could. We thought the atmosphere was going to damp sounds out a lot more, but it turns out we're hearing sounds at greater distances than we thought was possible. So that's really exciting.
Well, Matt, can we hear that wind sound one more time? Yeah, it's so low frequency, you don't hear the whoosh.
That's right. You know, if you held a microphone out just in the desert somewhere, you would absolutely hear, you know, on Earth, that higher pitched sound of the air traveling around your microphone, especially if you didn't have anything on there to prevent that. But of course, you know, on Mars, those sounds are there and you can look at the signal to actually find them, but you can't really hear them because they are so attenuated.
Yeah, really, really interesting. Well, okay, and another fascinating thing is in what you mentioned before is how cool is this? You get to operate a spacecraft with lasers on another planet. That's pretty neat. Let's listen to the sound of Perseverance zapping rocks. Ooh. Now, how many zaps has Percy done so far, approximately?
Oh, I should know that answer. I would say that we are probably in the, you know, thousands at this point. So that's because we do so many laser shots per sol, so per Martian day. But it's only, you know, we're only about 240 something sols into the mission. So we're just going to be building up more and more. But still, what we just heard there was, you know, I didn't count them, but that seemed like at least 10 to 15 shots right there. So we do that almost every single day.
And okay, well, you know, for our listeners who may not be aware, what's the purpose of zapping rocks on Mars?
Yes. So the zapping is coming from a laser-based technique that's part of the SuperCam instrument. So this laser is called laser-induced breakdown spectroscopy, or LIBS. And the way it works is that you actually focus a laser at a distance from the rover of, you know, up to 23 feet, so you don't have to touch the sample. And so you focus it and you make it really hot and you actually vaporize a little bit of that material. So you vaporize material, it makes this bright light. And then as that light is collected into the telescope back on the rover, we can actually tell what the rock is made out of. So we can see what the chemical elements are. And when you do this analysis under an atmosphere, it makes this snapping sound, as you heard. So it's not exactly a pew-pew, which is sort of disappointing, but it's still a pretty sharp sound that you can record.
And are you actually learning things from the sounds of the zaps, as well as, you know, the composition? What kinds of things do you learn from the actual sounds from the microphone?
the microphone actually adds a whole other dimension to Libs chemical analyses. My personal favorite thing to do with these is to try to see if there's a thin layer or a rock coating of some kind on the surface, because you can actually hear the change in that Libs zapping as you penetrate through one compositional layer into another. So we should be able to hear the sound of a rock coating if we find a rock that has one.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we return, we'll continue our look at, well, listen to, the sounds of Mars with Perseverance rover scientist Nina Lanza. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back. If you're just joining us, our guest is Los Alamos National Laboratory planetary scientist Nina Lanza, and we're talking about recent recordings made by the Perseverance rover listening to the sounds of Mars. I noticed that you in particular are interested in manganese minerals on Mars, correct?
Yes, I do love that element.
Why is that such a special element, and why are you so interested in it?
Manganese is really interesting for a lot of reasons. And the two main ones are just that it's a really good indicator of environmental conditions. It doesn't do a lot unless you meet certain conditions. And it's also really closely associated with life on Earth. When you look in the terrestrial geologic record, you can see that there aren't many manganese minerals, really no manganese minerals, until after the rise of photosynthesis. So after there was oxygen in the Earth's atmosphere. And this is because manganese requires really oxidizing conditions and a lot of liquid water to start forming minerals. So both of those things are really interesting when you think about whether or not those conditions were met on Mars. And so when we've seen with Curiosity, high concentrations of manganese in rocks, it brings up these questions. You know, was Mars not only wetter in the past, but maybe more strongly oxidizing and maybe had oxygen in its atmosphere?
Wow. So there's thought that there may have been photosynthetic organisms on Mars. That may be a possibility.
Well, that's a, you know, huge statement. We have no proof for that. So all I'm saying here is that we need to think about the possibility. How do we get enough oxygen or oxidizing enough conditions to make manganese minerals? They exist. So those conditions were met. How did we do that? I don't really know the answer. You know, there are ways that you can get oxygen into an atmosphere that's not photosynthesis. It could be totally abiological. And one way, and I'm waving my hands here, can't see, but one way you could do this is that, you know, as Mars was losing its magnetic field, you know, it had a greater incidence of incoming radiation that broke up water molecules into hydrogen and oxygen. And so hydrogen's light, it was lost to space. This is something that we, you know, we accept as something that's happened in the past on Mars. And that's why Mars is the red planet. It has all this oxygen that's oxidized the surface. But maybe at some point, oxygen built up in the atmosphere for a little bit and allowed these minerals to form. And that's just one potential scenario, one plausible way you could make oxygen without life. It would be a very short window in time. Now, of course, there are other options that are, you know, maybe more exciting. And that's why I think this is a really important element to study moving forward, because we'd like to know the answer to that. How did this happen and why?
Yeah, well, that's the whole reason we send a mission like Perseverance to Mars, is to ask those questions and try to find out the answers. And that's the fun part of science.
It's so fun. It's the best part. You know, people get really scared sometimes about not knowing the answer, but I think it's so much fun to be on this journey where we don't know the answer. We actually don't know at all right now the answer to these questions, but we can figure it out. And I know we will.
Okay, well, there's one more sound that's really, really cool, and that's the sound of Ingenuity, Jenny, the helicopter. And I thought this was really fun. Matt, can you play that?
How cool is that, right?
So that's the sound of the helicopter on Mars. And again, very low frequency.
Yeah, that's right. And that's not because there are not higher frequencies that are represented, but just because those are really attenuated. Mm-hmm. What's so cool about this sound is that we've actually been able to do science with it. It's not something that we intended to do, but it was something that was available. The helicopter represents essentially a consistent sound that is moving pretty far away from the rovers, because further away gets closer. And so we can actually get a sense of what a sound does in the atmosphere on Mars as it is at different distances, some of which are quite far, you know, like hundreds of meters. That's much further away than any sound that we can make on the rover itself. And so using the sound of the helicopter, that's how we were able to figure out actually sounds propagate a lot more easily in the Martian atmosphere than our models previously suggested.
Yeah, and ingenuity really is an engineering test, test of concept to prove that, yeah, you can fly, you know, these vehicles in the Martian atmosphere. But it's so cool that, you know, from it, because you have those microphones, we're getting science out of it.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, first of all, just flying a rotorcraft on Mars is an incredible accomplishment, and it's amazing. It's been working incredibly well. But we can actually get more science out of it than we previously thought. And I think that actually happens a lot more than you might realize. You know, we plan to do a lot of different scientific investigations before we go to Mars with these missions. But sometimes, you know, ideas come up as we're using our instrument suite, you know, things that we didn't think of before we launched can come up, and we can learn new ways of using our instruments to find out new data.
Yeah, it's very, really one of the cool things, the serendipity of a mission like this. You know, everybody thinks everything's fully planned out, but, you know, a lot of it is you learn as you go.
Yes, it's amazing actually how much serendipity plays a part in certain discoveries. You know, I remember I was on shift with Curiosity one day, and there was a rock shaped like a triangle, and I didn't have any other ideas. So I was like, we should totally just shoot that, you guys. And it turns out that that was one of the very first very high manganese targets that we had ever hit. And it was a weird triangle shape because it turns out it was a resistant fin, this sort of vein that was sticking out of the rock. And that's why it made this angular looking thing. But originally, you know, I didn't have any other ideas. I thought, well, that's a weird looking rock. So why not? Why not do it? We could very easily have not shot that. And then we would not have been able to make this manganese discovery.
Okay, one more sound that was really awesome to hear is, because it's fun to imagine yourself being with the rover, being with Perseverance or Curiosity, traveling, you know, slowly creeping along the surface of Mars. So let's listen to the sound of the rover tracks. So that's neat. And you can definitely hear those are like metallic sounds.
Yeah, you know, this doesn't sound like your car is in good working order, but that's actually just how our vehicle works on Mars, because the wheels of Perseverance are metal. And so if you can imagine, this is metal going over rocks and sand. So it's not actually all that nice a sound. If you go to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory and go to the Mars Yard to look at one of the rovers that they're testing, you know, that sound is actually really almost unbearable. There's a very high frequency component that thankfully is not in the Mars recording, but it's a very like squeaky, clanky sound. But that's actually totally normal for the wheels that we have.
What are some of the aspects of this that you can learn from, perhaps not just from a scientific point of view, but from an engineering point of view, to understand, you know, how's the rover's wheels performing and holding up?
Well, that's a great question. I'm not sure I've ever thought about it that way. I'm sure engineers have thought about that. You know, I imagine that as we record the sound of the wheels over time. You know, we'll do it. We can actually get a better sense of, you know, how are the grousers, that's the, you know, the ridges on there, are they holding together? Does that sound change? I wonder too, if the sound will change significantly depending on the terrain. We know exactly where we are from orbital data, and we know that's going to change as we traverse. So that'll be an interesting question to me. You know, how does the rock change the way the wheel sounds, and can that wheel sound be connected to state of health? You know, are the wheels performing as we expect? And if not, you know, can the sound help us understand why? Maybe there's a strain that's on those grousers that we can't really see in images alone.
But you can hear, and that would, you know, you'd have to be able to say, okay, we're going over the same kind of terrain, you know, maybe a year from now or much farther down the road, to be able to, you know, ask those questions.
Yeah, that's right. Well, we have the ability to actually see where we have been and where we're going just from this orbital data. We have a whole map. So we actually know, you know, when we're going to encounter similar terrain. So I think it's not an intractable problem.
Well, give us your sense of the big picture here for Perseverance now that it's been operating for several months. What are some of the things, you know, you've been most fascinated by that we are learning from Perseverance?
Well, I guess my first, you know, thing that I'm just so interested in seeing is just how different this landing site here in Jezero Crater is from Curiosity's landing site in Gale Crater. Mars is not the same everywhere. And we're really starting to get a better sense of that. You know, in Gale Crater, we landed on what was clearly, you know, lake and stream sediments immediately. And here in Jezero, even though we believe there was a lake there, you know, we've landed in a place that is a little bit more ancient that seems to be maybe some of the rocks that existed before the lake, which is really, really interesting to sort of think about how those rocks developed before the lake, maybe before even the crater existed, and then how they changed over time. We didn't have the opportunity to see such deep rocks in Gale Crater. And so this is providing us with a sort of a deeper window into time here in Jezero Crater, which I think is exciting.
Yeah, and you being part of the camera team, the images coming back, those panoramas are just so spectacular.
Oh, they are, aren't they? They're amazing. So I can't take credit for that because my camera takes a slightly different type of picture. So on Supercam, we have the remote micro imager, which also can take some of these panos. But the big, beautiful ones that you're likely thinking of is MastCam-Z, which is a set of cameras right below Supercam on the mast. And of course, those pictures, they're just so beautiful and detailed. It really makes you feel like you could be standing there, you know, and you can zoom in on little tiny rocks and see details. It's really incredible.
Yeah. And it is, you know, worth noting that there are many cameras in it. This is a fully loaded scientific laboratory cruising around there in Jezero Crater.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm trying to think of how many cameras there are, but there's at least double digits, right? There's so many cameras.
A lot.
Yeah. And we need them to do all kinds of different things. Then putting them together, they're at a lot of different scales. You know, there is the broad context cameras, there's the navigation cameras, there's, you know, these really close up images of like individual mineral grains. You can combine all of these views to get a really good sense of the geology of this area.
Well, we're about out of time, but before I let you go, you obviously really enjoy your work and are very passionate about it. What's one of your favorite things about your job working on this?
I think my favorite thing about working on these missions is that every day I get to log in and see something that no one has ever seen before. It's discovery in this really basic way. It's like you're hiking without a trail in the wilderness and no human being has ever seen it before. And you're the first to see it. And it's up to you to figure it out with your colleagues. I love that.
Yeah, that is very cool. Well, thanks for sharing all of this, especially the sounds of Mars from the microphones on Perseverance. And it, you know, it made me think, you know, the old movie line in space, no one can hear you scream. But hey, on Mars, we can listen to the helicopter and the wheels of the rover. So we get to hear some really cool stuff.
Yeah, totally. Hopefully no screaming from any of our equipment.
No, we don't want to hear that. It's a joy to talk to you, and it's really fun to hear about how Perseverance is doing. What a fantastic mission this has been so far.
It really has been. And thanks so much for having me.
Thanks to our guest, Dr. Nina Lanza. We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we return, we'll be joined by Princeton University physics professor and renowned space plasma expert Dave McComas to talk about the heliosphere, the bubble of charged particles that surrounds the sun, and an upcoming NASA mission to map it and its boundary with interstellar space. Stay with us. And we're we're back, and thanks for listening. Our next guest is Dave McComas. Dave is the Vice President of the Princeton Plasma Physics Laboratory and Professor of Astrophysical Sciences at Princeton, and he's been deeply involved during the past two decades in studying the heliosphere, the bubble of charged particles that surrounds the solar system before bumping into the boundary of interstellar space. Dr. McComas joined us recently to talk about that and a future NASA mission to help further our understanding of the interstellar boundary called IMAP, the Interstellar Mapping and Acceleration Probe. Dave McComas, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be back with you.
Yeah, it's always a joy to talk to you. I'm curious, I'd like to know, before we get into IMAP and this mission that you're involved with, how did you first really get interested in plasma physics and the heliosphere and all the particles that the sun puts out and all of this stuff? When did this first catch your interest?
Oh, boy, I don't know. I mean, I've always been interested in science and space ever since I was young. And then when I went to MIT as an undergrad, I was able to work at the Center for Space Research and start working on space research there. And it just stuck. It's just fascinating stuff. And so many unknowns and so many things that we can go out and measure and figure out and kind of move forward the knowledge of the state of the space around us.
Well, and that's what we want to talk about, is the space around us, because it's not as empty as people might think. Can you give us just a brief primer on the heliosphere and all of the particles that you're interested in?
Sure. I love to define the heliosphere for people, because so many people think that that's a word they've not heard before and it must be hard. But heliosphere is nothing more than the region of space dominated by the sun. Helios is the Greek word for the sun, and the sphere is just the region of influence. So basically what happens is the sun is constantly has an atmosphere, a hot atmosphere of gas that's sort of boiling off in space and accelerating out in all directions all the time. And it makes a wind, a supersonic wind that we call the solar wind. And that solar wind blows outward from the sun in all directions all the time. And it sort of inflates a bubble in the local interstellar medium. And these particles have a pressure to them. The magnetic fields have a pressure to them. And this bubble, which is largely material from the sun on the inside and material from the rest of the galaxy on the outside, that bubble is our heliosphere.
Yeah, and you've had some really interesting missions studying this. I'm trying to keep track of them all. How many missions have you been involved with as an investigator of one kind or another, probing the heliosphere now?
Yeah, I should know that number, but I don't. It's something over 30. Wow. Instruments that I've been involved in over my whole career.
Yeah, that's a lot.
So it's a lot. A lot of my work has been in trying to understand the solar wind itself and how it comes to be. I'm involved in the Parker Solar Probe mission, for example, where we're flying in very close to the sun, actually down through the solar corona. That's sort of one edge of our heliosphere is right at the sun. And the other edge of our heliosphere, I've spent the last decade or two really focusing on with the Interstellar Boundary Explorer mission, the IBEX mission, where we discovered a lot about what that interaction at the boundary of the heliosphere looks like. And now with the IMAP mission that we're building, which is, you know, a much bigger and more powerful mission to study that same region.
Yeah, and the solar corona, which I saw during the total solar eclipse of 2017, in August of 2017, was one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen in nature. It's just, it's almost impossible to describe. It's like, it's not a color I'd ever seen before, but it's beautiful. What have we learned about the corona so far from the Parker Solar Probe? Anything interesting?
Well, there are many, many, many interesting things that we've been learning from that. You know, we went there because we'd stared at the sun from the distance of the Earth for many decades. And, you know, you can see the sun in certain ways with remote imaging, but the real detailed plasma physics of how the solar wind is accelerated and heated and how energetic particles get accelerated, solar energetic particles, and those sorts of things, we just weren't able to answer those fundamental questions with the remote imaging. So getting instruments that can fly right through and measure the plasma, that's the ionized gas, and the magnetic and electric fields right in situ, where the action is, turns out to be the way that you get to the answers to those sort of fundamental questions. So we've been discovering lots of things. There are very interesting magnetic structures called switchbacks. There are flows that are more transverse than we expected. We're getting to see energetic particles in close to the sun, which are much lower intensity and lower energy than we've seen before. Signatures that get washed out by the time you get out to the distance of the Earth. So there's just a whole slew of wonderful things coming out from the Parker Solar Probe.
Cool. Well, let's talk about this future mission that you're involved with, IMAP. Tell us about what it kind of has twin goals. Could you tell us about what they are?
Yeah. So IMAP is the combination of the follow-on to the IBEX mission, which was the first mission to directly image the outer heliosphere and the interaction of the heliosphere boundaries with the local interstellar medium. So IMAP does that with three instruments instead of two, with much higher sensitivity and resolution than IBEX had. And at the same time, it's got another five instruments which measure the solar wind directly, energetic particles, the magnetic field, that sort of stuff in the solar wind, and tie together the two pieces where we see the solar wind, which flows out from the sun past our spacecraft, goes into the outer heliosphere, makes neutral atoms, energetic neutral atoms through charge exchange. And some of those come back in, and we image those on IMAP with our three IMAP ENA imagers, basically. And so it's kind of the full circle of life of these particles. So we're measuring both the acceleration processes, the transport of these particles, and then how they come back in and inform us about the outer heliospheric interaction. While I'm giving you the instruments, that was only eight. There are two other instruments. One of them does make some measurements of the ultraviolet light from the sun that helps us interpret these measurements. And the other one is a really fun measurement of interstellar dust. And so in addition to learning about the interstellar interaction from these energetic neutral atoms, we also measure dust grains which come floating into the heliosphere from outside in the local part of the galaxy. And that's another direct measure of the local interstellar medium for us.
Well, that's interesting. So there are actually dust grains from the interstellar region beyond the sun that make it into the heliosphere, into the bubble.
That's right, into the bubble, and there are direct neutral gas that makes it into the bubble that we measure with IMAP. There are these dust grains, and then there are these energetic neutral atoms. So we sort of have three different ways that we're measuring that interaction.
All right. Well, you're a physics professor, so I always found learning about the interstellar boundary explorer IBEX mission, the energetic neutral atoms, that I just found that to be fascinating. Could you explain to us the process of how those are created? Because that's really interesting.
Sure. So we start with a plasma, which is a set of atoms that have been heated or energized enough that they separate at least one electron from the atom. And that leaves what's called an ion, which is a positively charged atom that's lost in one or more electrons. And the electrons and the plasma is the combination of those two types of charged particles. The solar wind is a plasma. There are many plasmas. Fluorescent lights have plasmas in them. So the solar wind flows out and it's got these ions and electrons and magnetic field that's all flowing out from the sun and the solar wind. And in the outer heliosphere, there's very low energy neutral particles which are drifting in from the interstellar medium. And the interstellar medium is just full of both charged particles and neutral particles. Every now and then, when one of those neutral particles passes very close to one of the ions from the solar wind, an electron jumps across from one to the other. And when that happens, that turns that cold neutral that was coming in from the interstellar medium into an ion because it lost an electron. And the ion from the solar wind picks up the electron and becomes a neutral. And out at the edge of the heliosphere, after the solar wind has been heated, these energetic neutral atoms go zipping off in whatever direction they were heading at exactly the instant of that charge exchange. And because they're gyrating around the magnetic field, because they're charged particles, sometimes they come zipping right back into the inner heliosphere, and sometimes right back close to Earth to our satellite, and we're able to measure them directly. And so that's the signal, the ENA, energetic neutral atom signature that we're that we're observing. It's a direct measure of things happening hundreds of times further away from the Earth than the sun is.
Yeah. And where will IMAP be? At one of the Lagrange points?
Yeah. So IBEX was a small and inexpensive spacecraft, and it's just in orbit around the Earth. But there are a lot of backgrounds that adversely affect our measurements when you're in Earth orbit. And so instead for IMAP, we've targeted the L1 Lagrange point. That's the place about 1% of the distance towards the sun from the Earth. And that's a place where the sun and the Earth, the gravity from the two of them are pulling up equally. And it actually makes a gravitational null point between the Earth and the sun, where you can orbit around that null point and you're not, you know, you don't go in towards the sun, you don't go back towards the Earth, you just orbit around this place that's sort of 1% of the distance into the sun. And that point, of course, goes around the sun as we go around the sun over the course of the year. And so it's a really nice place to make measurements from. There have been a few spacecraft that have flown there before, and that's where IMAP's going.
And how many, I know you're the principal investigator, but there must be a pretty large team of investigators on this mission from all over the place. Could you give us a profile of who the people are working on this?
Sure. So we have a fantastic team. We have 24 institutions involved from 13 states and 6 countries. There are literally thousands of people working on IMAP right now. Our lead collaborating institution is the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Laboratory, or APL. They're building our spacecraft and doing mission management for us. But we have all these other institutions from universities and NASA field centers and national laboratories and lots of different places, a couple instruments coming from overseas, actually. And so it's this really big national and international consortium with just incredible people building the different instruments, the spacecraft, and putting together the whole mission.
And one of the things that I always find interesting about any space science mission, all of them, is that it takes, you know, years of preparation and planning and getting this all together before you actually get to a launch date. Could you talk about, you know, that aspect of it?
Yeah, so, you know, it's interesting. I would say that there are two things that really drive that strongly. The first is we're doing something new. You know, this isn't like building a car that you've built 1,000 of or 10,000 of or something like that. I mean, every spacecraft is different from the spacecraft before it. And even though in some ways parts of this follow on from IBEX and from other missions and there's some heritage in the instruments, in order to fly IMAP, each and every piece of it, from the spacecraft to all of the 10 instruments, has to be rethought, and you use some heritage, but then you make some modifications to make the right measurements from L1 instead of somewhere else, and that sort of thing. And so there's a lot of work to get that right. The second thing is, you know, it's not like something on Earth that if it breaks, you can just go fix it. And so you have to build something, you have to design something and build it with parts which are all super reliable, so that you have the maximum chance of this working a really long time in space. IBEX, for example, which was launched in the fall of 2008, is now 13 years into its mission. It was only designed for 2 years, but because we did such a good job and got a little lucky, I'm knocking on wood, got a little lucky, you know, we're now functioning 13 years after, 11 years longer than the design life of the spacecraft. So it takes a long time to do that engineering right and to get all the right quality parts, to do the right assembly and all of the testing that's needed before you can launch a real space mission.
So based on, you know, the fact that it's been 10 years since Voyager crossed the interstellar boundary there at the edge of the heliosphere, and you've been studying it through IBEX and from inside the heliosphere, what are some of the things that we know now from both Voyager and IBEX about that interesting boundary region out there that we didn't know before?
Yeah, sure. We know an incredible amount more than we knew before IBEX and the Voyager crossings. For example, probably the biggest thing is the IBEX ribbon. That's a swath of the sky out in the boundary region that emits energetic neutral atoms 2 or 3 times more intensely than anywhere else around the heliosphere. That was not anticipated by any prior theory or model. And since its discovery by IBEX, there have been, I think, 13 different suggestions of models or theories to explain it. I think we've been filling in a lot of information now with ibex about the ribbon and how it changes over time, for example, and are showing that we understand the source of it in something we call a secondary ENA source, where basically the solar wind makes neutral atoms that go out, get caught for a while on the magnetic field lines that surround the heliosphere and the local interstellar medium, and then become re-neutralized and come back in to make these ENAs. It's a really interesting model, and it actually informs us about the sort of detailed plasma physics in the local interstellar medium out beyond the boundary of the heliosphere itself. So I think we've learned a lot about the heliosphere from that. We also got very lucky in late 2014. The sun sort of lit up, turned on its solar wind. It's about a 40-50% increase in the solar wind dynamic pressure. This thing I've described as blowing the bubble, the solar wind that inflates this bubble in the interstellar medium. In late 2014, it just sort of started blowing harder. And that's been marvelous for us, because starting in late 2016, early 2017, we started to see the enhanced energetic neutral atoms coming back from the heliospheric boundaries from this higher intensity solar wind. And that's allowed us to chart sort of the progression of that pressure front moving through the outer heliosphere. It's told us a lot about the shape of the heliosphere. It's told us a lot about the interaction and the production of these ENAs. So there are a couple really major things that we've been doing, but there have been literally many hundreds of papers on IBEX alone. Similarly on Voyager, there have been, you know, some real breakthroughs in understanding what the interstellar medium looks like from the direct in situ measurements that the Voyagers have made. And my own personal favorite part about all this is it's the combination of the two that's so powerful, because we have these two probes in the Voyagers, Voyager 1 and 2, in these two locations, which we have very precise knowledge, but we don't know anything about the big picture of the heliospheric interaction. And with IBEX and IMAP coming soon, we've got the three-dimensional global image of the entire heliosphere. So we know what's going on all over, but we don't have the detailed knowledge like you do from the Voyagers. And so synthesizing those two things into the physical understanding has been just dynamite for the field.
Yeah. And to put it into perspective for us, why is the heliosphere so important to us for life on Earth?
Well, it's our home. You know, this is our home in the galaxy. This is the protective shield that the sun carries around with it as it goes around the galaxy, sort of bobbing up and down through different local interstellar media. Sometimes, you know, higher density, lower density, things like that. It actually provides protection for the solar system. About 90% of the million electron volt MeV cosmic radiation that would otherwise be coming into the Earth is shielded out by this interaction region out of these boundaries. So, you know, we talk about sending people to Mars someday and you know, spending more time in space with humans. Wouldn't even be possible if it weren't for the heliosphere protecting us and shielding out the vast majority of the galactic cosmic radiation. So there are practical applications of it, but mostly from my perspective as a scientist, it's our home. And you know, one of the things that humans do is explore the space around us, explore the regions around us, so that, you know, we understand how we are, what we are, and where we're living.
Yeah, and my favorite aspect of that is it's mysterious and it's fascinating. And watching scientists like yourself unravel these mysteries is, you know, is most of the fun.
It's a lot of fun. And going home at the end of the day and knowing something that you didn't know when you went in and nobody in the world knew, and now you and maybe a few people you're working with know it, and you're going to write it up and tell the rest of the world is just an incredible high.
Yeah, well, thanks for sharing all this with us, and best of luck with IMAP in the future. Before I let you go, we interviewed Dr. Robert Ballard recently, and it was a lot of fun to talk to him. And he discussed how he has dyslexia, and I know you do too, and have been involved in this. But he made some really interesting points to me about how he's turned it to an advantage, and how in his work as an undersea explorer, he kind of sees in pictures. He just has a brain that works in a totally different way, and it's been, you know, advantageous to him. I'm wondering, you know, for you, do you have things that where you can like visualize things like the heliosphere in ways that you may not have been able to if you hadn't been dyslexic?
Yeah, I think so. And I'm aware of his work, which is absolutely wonderful. And I am actually a big believer in that, you know, the strengths, looking at the strengths of dyslexia as well as the issues with it. I didn't learn to read till fourth grade, and I'm still a terrible reader and an even worse speller. So, you know, there's a downside, but the upside is I started to think very three-dimensionally, very visually. I don't have a problem thinking about this complicated structure out at the boundaries of the solar system and, you know, in very sort of graphic kind of ways. And, you know, I think that people with different sort of brain structures and different capabilities learn in different ways, and they're able to advance knowledge in different ways. And, you know, sort of the combination of all of us working together and using our strengths is probably how we get the best research done.
Yeah, and I find that to be the best message of all of this is for especially for kids. You know, it's like they all are different and they all learn in different ways. And it's if you can harness that different way of learning, you know, you can unleash somebody into a very powerful person.
Absolutely.
Well, Dave, it was fun to talk to you as always, and we'll touch base again in the future, I hope, as we get closer to launch. And best of luck with IMAP.
Great. Thanks so much, Dave. Great to talk with you as always.
Thanks again to our guests, Nina Lanza from the Los Alamos National Laboratory and Perseverance Rover SuperCam team scientist. You can learn more about her work and check out the sounds on Mars recorded by Perseverance at ninalanza.com. And thanks to Princeton University astrophysics professor Dave McComas. You can check out more about the IMAP mission at imap.princeton.edu. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of CAP Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.